the afternoon magazine on WILL, AM 580. Celeste Quinn is away. I'm Tom Rogers. 1996 was a watershed year for the American commercial radio industry. For years before that, media companies were already merging and creating nationwide groups of stations, in some cases swallowing up independent owners, and stations were starting to sound the same from market to market. But by 1996, the government gave companies the chance to buy up even more stations, including multiple stations in the same market. And it helped give rise to a small group of big radio conglomerates. The group was headed by Clear Channel Communications, which was founded in San Antonio, Texas, and quickly became not just a radio powerhouse, but the dominant billboard company and the dominant live concert promoter in the U.S. Clear Channel's managers called it synergy. It's being able to consolidate their sales and operations. But synergy also helped create a backlash. Radio stations became even more monolithic and, in many people's eyes, predictable. And Clear Channel was a poster child for what was wrong with the industry. Well, how did Clear Channel get so big and then so hated? For those questions, we turn to author Alex Foge in the Afternoon Magazine. His book is called Right of the Dial. It looks at the perfect storm of deregulation and politics and business savvy that created Clear Channel Communications and helped lead it to get cut down some in the recent past. Alex Foge is an author who has written for many magazines, and he joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Alex.
Good afternoon, Tom.
And I noticed that your two previous books touched on the rock group Sonic Youth and Pat Robertson. So you have a wide variety of things that you have written about in the immediate past.
That's true. Yeah, I have a lot of background writing about the media business. This book was kind of my first major foray into the radio business.
And you found it, how did you get interested in it? You mentioned in the preface of the book, and that's why I picked the music for the opening, that you started hearing some of the same things that people started complaining about in radio, about formats being pretty much homogenized from coast to coast.
Right. You played a little excerpt from Kashmir by Led Zeppelin. I should point out, I have no issues with Led Zeppelin. I like their music a lot.
So do I.
Just not all the time. And at the beginning of the book, I talk about taking a road trip with my family and going from state to state and tuning into yet another classic rock station playing once again Kashmir by Led Zeppelin. And, you know, I think that, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and I have no nostalgia about radio, really. There was no golden era that I witnessed. Mm-hmm. I think even before Clear Channel came to prominence, there was already a lot of homogenization of what you would hear on the radio, particularly with music broadcasting. And but I think, as I explain in my book, Clear Channel, by sheer fact of its growing size and dominance in the industry, really pushed a lot of these things to a level they hadn't been experienced before.
And we, before I go too much further, let's remind people in the audience that they are able to call in, and you can ask your questions of Alex Foge about Clear Channel and the radio industry and the book. Our number in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455, 333-WILL. Outside the area, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. So why is it that Clear Channel gets tagged as the company that the people most associate with this what they feel is a bad trend in commercial radio?
Well, the number one reason I think is what the size that they grew to. You started off by mentioning the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which allowed radio companies to own essentially as many stations as they could buy up. And Clear Channel wasn't the only company out there that started buying up more radio stations, but they clearly had a different strategy, because by the time they were done, they had amassed about 1,200 stations across the country. Their closest competitor only had about 400 stations, and a lot of those stations were in major media markets, and as you mentioned, up to the legal limit of how many stations they could own in each of those markets. And so the fact of the matter was is that for a short period of time, Clear Channel really was the radio industry, and even as they are starting to sell off some of their stations now, they continue to be a mark of where the radio industry is going. And, you know, they've been tagged fairly in some cases, unfairly in others, with what everything that people perceive being wrong with radio.
Now, you mentioned fairly early on in the book that you tried to get to some of the management of Clear Channel to talk about the company. You said that you wanted to do a fair book about the company, and it was hard to get them to agree. And you say that's not uncommon for Clear Channel.
No, and I think that their attitudes towards the press and the public in general probably have helped get them into more trouble than a lot of other things that they've done in a funny way. You alluded to, you know, how did I stumble onto this subject in the first place? I think, like a lot of other radio fans and music fans out there, the first I'd ever heard of Clear Channel was it with negative connotations. I mean, they were by the year 2000 really being attacked pretty publicly. A couple years later, when Howard Stern left commercial radio for satellite radio, he went on David Letterman and blamed it all on Clear Channel. So, you know, a lot of people who couldn't name a single radio group before then suddenly knew the name Clear Channel, and it wasn't for good reasons. And so, you know, that had a pretty major effect.
And before then, Clear Channel was just a player, I guess, before 1996. It was, I guess, it had maybe a quiet upbringing, I suppose, right?
Well, it had a lot to do with the fact that they began in San Antonio, Texas. They're still based in San Antonio, Texas.
Right.
By no means a major media hub. And I think that until they started really amassing a large number of stations and until they purchased the largest concert promoter in the country, most people, including a lot of people in the media business and in the radio business, weren't all that familiar with them. They were a pretty sleepy little company from Texas.
And you document a lot about how the company sort of quietly worked and a bit of its earlier history and the founder of Clear Channel, who was not a radio person, a man by the name of Lowry Mays, a Texas businessman, I guess, who considered Clear Channel really an investment, I suppose, at first.
Well, the legend is that Lowry Mays, who started his career as an investment banker, kind of stumbled into owning his first station.
Mm-hmm.
He was backing a loan of a friend to purchase a small FM station, and at the last minute, the friend backed out, and he was left holding the bag, and called up a friend of his named Red McCombs, who is a car dealer in San Antonio, who figured he knew a lot about the radio business, or at least as much as anybody he knew about the radio business, since he bought a lot of advertising. And together they decided that maybe the radio business wasn't such a bad business to be in. Historically, radio has had some of the highest profit margins in the media business, and Lowry Mays realized pretty quickly that he might be able to make this into a real going concern. And as he found out pretty quickly, a lot of radio stations were real mom-and-pop operations back then and could use a little bit of business know-how. And so pretty quickly, he was able to start making a few more stations work for him financially.
Yeah, there was some talk later in the book about some of the larger owners kind of dissing the smaller mom-and-pop stations for not really taking advantage of what they had.
That's true. I mean, you know, it's a conversation that you know, is not really about the content
right.
put out by any radio stations, but you know, I think that particularly in the 70s, at a lot of rock stations around the country that were independently owned, you know, people who owned them like to think they were getting into the entertainment business. And sort of all of the virtues and vices that come with that, I guess. And Lowry Mays and his executives didn't look at it that way. In their mind, they were in the advertising business. And from San Antonio, Texas, they didn't feel any camaraderie with the entertainment business at all, regardless of what kind of station they owned. And, you know, I think for the early years of the company, it served them very well. I mean, their companies, their stations made money, and the company started growing, and you know, they gained a reputation as being a cheap channel. That was the early moniker slapped on the company. And in the early days, though, they wore that with pride. They felt like they really knew how to make these little stations work and turn into cash machines.
How were they able then to sort of merge that, you know, that advertising knowledge, I suppose, or it, you know, the goal of the stations is being advertising medium strictly with the radio people who came to work for them, and they did have to lean, I guess, on some radio people early on.
Oh, they did, and a lot of the early executives had pretty deep radio experience and had a real passion for radio. And what's interesting is that for many of the early years of Clear Channel, their strategy was pretty much to buy stations, and if they were doing okay, to pretty much let those stations do what they were doing, mm-hmm. let the program manager, put their finger on the local market, and let the local ad salespeople do what they needed to do. And as long as they met their numbers, they were pretty much left alone. That changed in that period after 1996, in part because of a merger with a radio company called J-Core, which was out of Cincinnati, and Randy Michaels, who now is actually at the Tribune Company, was a big engineer in the second phase of Clear Channel, which is one that a lot of people would argue was the one that really got them into trouble with the public.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about, Randy Michaels in a little bit. And yes, he's now in charge of broadcasting, but only with Tribune, with Tribune Company, a fairly small, comparatively speaking, radio and television operation. But and now he's the chief operating officer, too, so I guess he has a role in newspapers as well. You document the slow growth of Clear Channel before that time in 1996. Explain a little about how it got to be where it was in that period, was there a change in the way that they managed those radio stations in that time, aside from letting the station owners, the station managers there, the existing ones, do what they had done before?
Well, I think the main change was as they got a little bit bigger, that they were less able to keep tabs on the individual stations, and it became clear. I mean, two of their main early strategies started, getting them a little bit into. They sort of presaged what would come later. One being the focusing much more on sales and ad sales than on content. I mean, obviously. When you're a little local station, you need to do what you need to do to pay the bills and to pay your salaries. When you get bigger, people start expecting a little bit more, and you're competing. You know, as they start acquiring larger stations, those stations were expected to compete against those of other companies that perhaps had more compelling content. So I think you sort of hit a wall after a while if you're focused solely on ad sales. So that was one issue. And then, I think this notion of consolidating operations, a light bulb kind of went off over Larry Mays' head, and he realized there might be some real virtue in getting bigger, in fact, very bigger, if the law allowed it. And soon enough, it did, and I think that even before the company started enacting this new strategy, it was sort of pushing towards there logically.
Although the formulaic format has been around, it preceded Clear Channel by quite a bit. But only how was Clear Channel sort of fomenting that change to making formats even a little more? To a specific formula and not a regional kind of format?
Well, that really started kicking in after 1996.
Uh-huh.
Because at that point, as you said, I mean, there were a lot of these radio formats out there before then, clearly, and we're already, from classic rock to easy listening to, the familiar format that are now everywhere. Top 40 obviously had been around for years and years. In fact, it was, as I discovered in writing this book, was really invented in Texas. So there was a good bit of radio history there for the modern era.
Right.
It was particularly when Randy Michaels came into the picture that there was a real focus on cost-cutting through technology, for one. Voice tracking, which has been around for years, which is where you can take a DJ in some remote location and essentially dial out broadcasts all over the country and then strip in the local ads. What Clear Channel did to really embellish this strategy was they would actually have DJs pretend they were in the local markets, mm-hmm. peppering their comments with some references to local landmarks, the local weather, things like that. Really give the impression to people listening locally that the DJ was right nearby when, in fact, he could have been thousands of miles away. And so that was one thing they did. They also started doing the voice tracking at a level and scope that hadn't been seen before. Again, all in the name of cutting costs and figuring people didn't really know the difference.
And you did talk about a couple of fairly high-profile situations where that was called into question. The situation of an incident in North Dakota a few years ago where there was a chemical explosion, a train derailment, and the story grew to that the police were not able to contact anybody at the stations because they had all been voice tracked overnight and there was nobody on duty and that was one of those high profile stories that got Clear Channel in trouble with Congress and in trouble in the public opinion. Explain a little about how that all unfolded.
Right, you're talking about Minot, North Dakota,
right.
Which is became a landmark incident. There was this tanker of gas that exploded essentially, and noxious gases were spread. And because the Clear Channel station wasn't actually manned by somebody who could go on the air, there was no place for them to disseminate the emergency information. Later on, Clear Channel actually claimed that there was a new emergency system that had been put in place that wasn't working properly. But, regardless of what the actuality of the incident was, there was already a resonance, and this happened to Clear Channel a number of times over the years after 1999, 2000, where everything that was ascribed to them wasn't always their fault, but they had this real public relations problem because they had done a lot of these bad things or people, that people perceived as being bad things that had hurt radio or that were not good for listeners and created a lot of enemies even within the radio industry and within the entertainment industry.
Our guest is Alex Foch. He's the author of a book called Right of the Dial on Clear Channel Communications, The Rise of Clear Channel and the Fall of Commercial Radio. That's the Afternoon Magazine today, and we invite you to call in your questions for Alex Foch. Our number is 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Outside the calling area, 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. So the Telecommunications Act of 1996 was sort of that event that that broke Clear Channel into the extremely large scale operation that it was at that point. Explain a little about how Clear Channel approached that, how they helped foment that act and the fortune that they hit upon once it was passed.
Well, I mean, clearly leading up to when that act was signed, there was a lot of lobbying by the radio industry as a whole. There were a lot of station owners that felt that in order to compete in the rapidly expanding media universe that they couldn't be held to restrictions that were no longer relevant. President Clinton actually signed the bill that included that provision that removed the ownership caps. I mean, most of that bill was actually about telecommunications.
I was going to say station ownership was almost an afterthought, it seemed.
Yeah, it was. It was a very minor part of it. And from my research, I learned essentially that to get some of what he wanted in television, President Clinton agreed to this this change for the radio business. You know, a lot of people after the fact said that, it was unfortunate that, it had gone that way, even some of the the legislators that voted for it. But ultimately, what the radio industry was claiming came to be true in a few years. Mm-hmm. With the advent of the internet, iPods, satellite radio, suddenly there wasn't, there was a lot more competition for traditional radio. And in retrospect, I think that what's happening now is that the market is sort of correcting itself, as it were, and commercial radio is actually having a pretty hard time these days.
And that's what's keeping Clear Channel from growing more than it had, and
right.
Maybe is forcing it to retract a bit.
Well, suddenly, owning 1,200 radio stations doesn't seem like such a great idea.
Yeah.
So, especially when you're having, not to say that commercial radio isn't still making some money, but the future isn't looking very bright.
Let's go to a phone call right now. Again, the number is 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. We'll go to line one in Urbana. Good afternoon. You're on with Alec Foge.
Oh, hello. Listening to the guest, if I'd never heard of Clear Channel before, I'd have thought he was simply talking about a clever bunch of businessmen who'd maximized their profits and made a killing in a way nobody had ever thought of before. And yet, the only time I have ever heard of Clear Channel, mentioned, was as a mouthpiece of the right-wing propaganda network all over the country.
And that's something that they had built up in a couple of different areas and exercised political influence, obviously, on that time.
Right. I mean, it's interesting that that I think that's certainly a perception, and it's one that I explored in my book. Certainly, Lowry Mays and a lot of the other top executives at the company have been pretty open about their affiliations with the Republican Party. Lowry Mays, is a good friend of the first President Bush, and although in the past, in an earlier time, he was a Democrat, in fact. But there were certain incidents that were attached to Clear Channel that gave an impression that they were a very right-wing organization. I think what I learned in my research was ultimately, I think that they were motivated by profits. It's not to say that they didn't have a Republican worldview about things, but once I delved into some of the more famous incidents, a lot of them were kind of hard to pin down. A famous one was after the Iraq War began, that purportedly a sheet of songs that weren't allowed to be played on Clear Channel stations was circulated among station managers, banning certain songs they felt wouldn't be appropriate. Famously,
John Lennon's song.
Yeah, Imagine by John Lennon was on that
imagine
list.
Imagine all the people.
And nobody could really fathom why that would be included on that list unless they were actually against peace. But
possibly the Dixie Chicks. I'm not sure.
Well, it's interesting. See, a lot of people attached Clear Channel to that Dixie Chicks incident, where after the Dixie Chicks stated that they were embarrassed to come from Texas after the war began, but in fact that was a competitor of
yes,
Clear
I thought that was the country music stations.
Yeah, well, they owned some country music stations, but that was I don't want to say the name, but I'm not exactly sure which one it was, but it wasn't Clear Channel, and
but
people already had this perception that Clear Channel might do something like that, so they got blamed for it.
Anything else? There we are.
I guess not. It's just odd that you just made them sound like clever businessmen like, for instance, the people who founded Woolworth, the chain of Woolworth department stores.
Well, you're right, and
innocent people who were serving a national need.
Right. No, I think that that's accurate, and I think that that's, in some ways, the way they've always looked at the company. I think where things get a little difficult in radio is that traditionally in this country, radio was established back at the beginning of the 20th century as a service that operates in the name of the public. These are and the airwaves are owned by the public, which is why we have the FCC. And so there, although it's changed dramatically over the years, there's always been this understanding that even though radio companies are commercial enterprises, that they have some obligation to provide information and culture and entertainment to the public. And I think that a lot of people felt over the years that Clear Channel nearly abandoned that mission.
Right. Well, thanks for your call. Let's go on to line two on a cell phone in Champaign. Good afternoon. You're with Alec Foge.
Hi. Interesting. You already have one of my questions, because I was calling to actually ask about the Dixie Chicks. So Clear Channel, that was another format station manager or management company that made that choice?
Yes, that is the case. I mean, it's not to say that they haven't been targeted in other ways, especially related to the Iraq War. I mean, there was another situation where apparently station managers that worked for Clear Channel were organizing what amounted to pro-war rallies in the early months.
Well, sure. Okay.
Corporate later said that these station managers were doing it on their own, which seems very unlikely. But they certainly were involved in some very public situations that reinforced a right-wing political view. But, by the same token, these days Rush Limbaugh is an employee of Clear Channel, although they did not build his career. They simply bought Premier Radio Network, which broadcasts his show. In commercial radio, particularly in the talk format, right-wing radio is where the money is, so
sure.
you could argue that's why they're involved in all these situations.
Well, I think then, since you answered the political question, I'll ask about the music. Kind of interesting what's happened. It started about, 93 or 94, and it's funny that you chose Led Zeppelin, because we have a local classic rock station that's starting actually probably in the mid to late 80s. We all noticed, hey, you're going to hear Led Zeppelin once an hour, and it became pretty much a joke that, it was the Led Zeppelin station, which is funny because I've noticed recently that a lot of the formats is they only play, like, the top five songs. They don't play a top 20 list, and they don't play, like, the top 100 songs. They just play the top five songs. But I did notice something interesting when we traveled to Florida 2 years ago. There's still a whole lot of regional variation once you get south of Tennessee, which I thought was real interesting. So if you could comment on maybe the consolidation of formats and how, in the 70s you had rhythm and blues, African-American music mixing with the Osmonds, white pop music, with Carlos Santana and all these other people who would be classified as rock now. And now all these formats have been kind of settled out, and I don't think they really reflect the viewing public's choices, but I'll sit back and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, I agree with you on that. I mean, I think that, people who are old enough remember the days when not only was there more variety overall on radio, but even within certain genres and formats that you would hear, there would be more variety. Interestingly enough, in later years, particularly when Clear Channel went before Congress in congressional hearings about this, Lowry Mays claimed that Clear Channel actually offered more diversity than ever before, thanks to owning all these stations, and rattled off names of any number of formats that they broadcast. But if you start parsing through those formats, they're as you described. They have very short playlists, or there's a lot of overlap between different formats, And pretty quickly you can figure out that the diversity is in name only and not in the variety of music or programming that you hear. And, you know, I unfortunately think that became the norm, and not just a Clear Channel. And I think that particularly young people have sort of voted with their ears and gone elsewhere. I mean, if you look at the numbers for listenership in radio in recent years, other than NPR, which actually has had a big uptick, commercial radio numbers are going down, particularly in those younger demographics, because, of course, you've got music file sharing online, you've got internet radio stations, you've got satellite radio, which was really built as a business on the notion that commercial radio wasn't giving people what they wanted. And you have iPods, of course, which, you can really program your own radio station in your head. Mm-hmm. So I think by not offering a big variety of programming and having very short playlists, I think, Clear Channel and other companies really shot themselves in the foot.
Now they're trying to address that, I guess, maybe retroactively. They have something called Radio Lab, but you mentioned that that only goes so far as diversity of music.
Right. Well, another interesting initiative that actually Clear Channel is spearheading in the past couple years is what's known as HD Radio, which
right.
hasn't really gotten much traction yet, I think in part because of the name. People know what HD television is, but HD radio doesn't necessarily make much sense. It's essentially digital radio. You need to buy a new radio, which costs a couple hundred dollars to hear it. And not only can you hear your favorite stations in digital sound, but many of those stations have multiple channels on them. And so ostensibly it's an idea that allows stations to program more content and more variety on those sub-stations or sub-channels. But as I said, it hasn't really taken off yet. It may have some value in the future, though.
Let's get back to where Clear Channel was probably at its mightiest once it purchased J-Corp, as you mentioned, back in the late 90s, and brought in Randy Michaels, who was with that company as sort of the person in charge of programming. How was that a transformative moment, and how did that lead to the backlash and to the little retraction?
Well, the biggest thing to understand about when J-Corp merged with Clear Channel was that traditionally Clear Channel was a real button-down kind of company, business-like managers who knew how to make their budgets and all of that. J-Corp came from the opposite end of the spectrum. Randy Michaels got his start as one of the original shock jocks and was known for his outrageous behavior and he once had strippers come into a big broadcasting meeting, and he was definitely a wild child of radio, and those two cultures together really kind of clashed. And I think the combination of Clear Channel sort of tough guy negotiation tactics combined with Randy Michaels' outrageous tactics really kind of made things very explosive. The other thing that happened was right around that time, too, they purchased SFX, which was a company that had rolled up all of the local concert promoters around the country that had traditionally been local businesses. And so suddenly, out of the blue, Clear Channel also became the largest concert promoter in the country.
Which you mentioned caused would give people the impression of a conflict of interest.
Right. I mean, their idea was the notion, and they weren't the only media company doing it this time, of engineering some sort of synergy. They also, by that time, owned the largest billboard company in the country.
So they'd be able to sell all of this at the same time.
Right. And the idea was that they could, somebody would be driving to a concert, listening to a Clear Channel station. They would see a Clear Channel billboard, and then they would show up at a venue either owned or controlled by Clear Channel that was festooned with advertising, and they could sell a major media package to large advertisers around the country, and they felt that they could do this at a premium. What happened in the end, of course, was that large advertisers were expecting a discount in this situation if they were going to buy this much advertising from one company. And it was also an issue of media buyers for each different medium usually work on their own. So it was hard to sort of, you know, sell this big concept to a large advertiser that was used to sort of buying all the pieces that it wanted separately. But what really got them in trouble was that the music industry and music fans really started expressing outrage. Rumors started circulating that Clear Channel stations were threatening artists that didn't play their venues. They were threatening that they wouldn't play them on their radio stations. And as you can imagine, musicians and record companies were outraged by that. And tangentially, music fans started getting upset about this, and that's when everything really blew up into this big fireball of bad publicity.
And at that point, the word payola started going around again.
Right, and again, payola is something that Clear Channel by no means invented. Payola has been around at least since the original 50s rock and roll era, maybe even earlier than that. And although it's been prosecuted a number of times over the years, I'm told it's always around in some shape or form. It just kind of takes different forms. It's the notion that record companies, through middlemen, pay radio stations to play songs that they've issued. And, you know, this practice in general, it hurts artists. It ultimately hurts radio as well. I mean, I think most listeners assume that what they're hearing on the radio is there because it's popular, because people, that's what people want to hear. But, you know, if it's not the case and songs are getting on there because somebody paid them to be there, you know, the radio stations ultimately may lose listenership because of something like that. And Clear Channel at some point made a very unusual decision, they felt, business-like decision of saying that we know that payola exists, but what we're going to do is we're going to request that all payments be sent to corporate headquarters rather than to station managers. Therefore, the station managers won't be tainted, and you know, with the notion of playing favorites. Of course, when they tried to explain this to investors in earnings conference calls, some of which are recounted in the book, it sounded awfully strange.
and explaining that to Congress was equal.
Right, and then explaining it to Congress was even harder. And in fact, famously, John McCain was one of the senators that really really gave Lowry Mays a hard time in asking him, what, you know, were they involved in this or not? And Lowry Mays never really gave him a straight answer.
We've got one more call here on the line, on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi. Did you look into the FCC and their particular role? Because I know there's been a lot of criticism there that, you know, the fellow that's over the FCC and then the previous one, too, in terms of, you know, just not looking out for the public interest.
You mentioned Mark Powell playing a big role in
that. Yeah, Michael Powell.
Michael Powell, thank you.
Colin Powell's son was the FCC during that key period. And although many have said he, in fact, didn't actually do anything that fostered that environment, he certainly was a big proponent of deregulating, you know, virtually every aspect of the broadcasting industries, and certainly fostered that mindset, although he didn't actually have any role in making Clear Channel bigger or allowing it to get bigger. The current FCC chair, Kevin Martin, ironically, is the one who has, you know, right now Clear Channel has been trying to go private for the past year and a half, in part because of some of these difficulties. Their stock price has really been stagnating in recent years because of some of the issues we've discussed. And but FCC approval has been hard to come by in a certain deal. ironically, because of the head of the FCC. So there may be some shift in the understanding on that level. Although I would actually argue that the whole issue has kind of changed since the last time this really came to a head, primarily because more and more listeners have many more choices and ways to get radio and music. And in fact, I think in a few years you'll start seeing wireless internet access in the car. And by that point, some of these regulatory issues will be almost moot because once you have access to any content you'd like with wireless internet access, then radio stations are going to really have to scramble like everybody else out there to be heard.
All right. Thanks for your phone call this afternoon. Somebody in the studio actually reminded me that even though Clear Channel was this sprawling organization that had stations all over the country, we don't actually have any Clear Channel stations in this particular market in central Illinois or western Indiana. What is a person who listens to radio in this area? What can they see as Clear Channel's influence in areas where they may not have had stations above and beyond, as you mentioned, Rush Limbaugh, who is a Clear Channel employee indirectly, being heard everywhere?
Well, I think that, as I said a little bit earlier, Clear Channel does at this point is what the radio industry does ultimately. And, it almost doesn't matter whether there are any Clear Channel stations in your market, because whoever the competitors are in that market likely have stations in other markets where Clear Channel does exist and, have been forced to embrace the notion that the Clear Channel way of doing things is the way to do things. And so as playlists have gotten shorter and voice tracking became more common, all of those issues are practices that on some scale were adopted by many of their competitors.
But those practices still survive even though the company that did them that was in the forefront of them is not doing so well.
Right. I think that like some other businesses that have been used to doing things a certain way for a long time, I think the radio business has been fairly entrenched, and it's only now. In some ways, it's being forced to change its ways. I mean, ironically, Clear Channel has become probably at the top of companies, at least on the surface, trying to change the way they do things. So I think that the real effect you're going to see is as they continue to sell off some of their smaller and medium-sized stations, other smaller companies will acquire those stations. And ironically, in this era, the way for radio to really compete is to go back to its local roots, because the internet is really still a national medium when it comes to advertising, and radio still has some real advantages on the local level. So I think what you're going to see at Clear Channel and at other companies is a push towards more local programming and more local advertising, and so it may. Push us towards a renaissance in radio.
And they'll have many more vehicles available to them if HD radio catches on.
Correct.
What about as sort of a postscript? You mentioned that Randy Michaels is now at Tribune Company. What might people at Tribune Company be thinking with him in charge of what kinds of a business mentality he'll bring to that organization?
Well, I've kept up with it a little bit, and from what I know, I mean, obviously the newspaper business is having very serious difficulties right now, and I know that Randy Michaels has been brought in as somebody who's going to shake things up, and it seems like so far that's what they're doing. I know they recently announced that a number of the top Tribune papers are going to be having, fewer pages, mm-hmm. and a 50-50 split between content and advertising. And I think that I would imagine that there are more job cuts in the works. So I mean, it's hard to make a total comparison. I mean, radio and newspaper are obviously very different businesses, but you know, there is a rough comparison there, I guess, in terms of you know, consolidation, maybe homogenization over time. I mean, it doesn't look great for Tribune newspapers, it seems like, at this point. But then again, the newspaper business is having a tough time no matter how you slice it. So, so I guess the attitude is, you know, let's try something new. Anything might work.
All right. Alex Foch, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks, Tom.
It's been a good hour, and Alex Foch's book, again, is called Right of the Dial, The Rise of Clear Channel and the Fall of Commercial Radio, and it is published by Faber & Faber.